Hey, Gestalt Education Nation. New sponsor alert, new sponsor alert. Today, we're excited to announce Dynamic Disc Designs and Jerome Fryer. We have an awesome discount code for you. Just use the code Gestalt to get a little bit of money off on the Dynamic Disc Designs. They're the most realistic anatomical discs that we've ever seen. If you caught our episode with Dr. Stuart McGill, you saw an entire shelf full of them. Everything from cavitation instruction to disc dysfunction to SI joint dysfunction, all sorts of amazing
joint
stuff.
Joint movement, vertebral movement.
Absolutely. So go to Dynamic Disc Designs, use the code Gestalt. As always, you can use the code Gestalt on Core 360 belt to get a little discount on the belts there. We love to use that for biofeedback, for teaching respiration, intra-abdominal pressure, and how the abdominal wall should be working during function. And then the last one, use the code GestaltEducation10. Those will all be in the description in the podcast. GestaltEducation10 at humanlocomotion.com to get off some money off of all of his awesome gadgets and tools and rehab materials. What's your favorite, Brett?
He's got a trunk full, but I think, you know, integrating the Toe Pro in, I think, has been a game changer for us here at the office. So I think that would be my pick.
Beautiful. All right, guys, don't forget, use the code Gestalt, Gestalt Education 10. Visit the show notes and you'll be hooked up. Thanks. Enjoy the episode. All right, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Gestalt Education Show. Today, we are back in Troy, Missouri at Casa de Winchester down here in your basement. So, Brett, in the early days of Gestalt, we had some insane post-seminar parties down here.
Oh, yeah.
So, finally...
My wife put it into those, which is probably a good idea.
It was a great idea. So, we had some mini late nights in here. And so, today, we are excited. This is our yearly tradition. Every December, we're just going to keep pulling them out to Troy, but we're sitting down with Dr. George Paletta. Dr. Paletta is the head orthopedic surgeon for the St. Louis Cardinals. He's my head orthopedic surgeon too for Troy to Buchanan. And so unfortunately or fortunately, I've been able to send him a lot of patients recently, and especially on this topic, which is the ACL. So Brett, we've been lucky to sit down with Tim Hewitt. We've had a lot of different opinions on this, and we thought you're obviously the expert in the world when it comes to the elbow and the shoulder, but you do a pretty damn good job with the knee too. And so we thought it'd be great to get your opinions on the latest and greatest with ACL, graft types, return to play, all that kind of stuff. So I think just to start it off, Dr. Paletta, can you just maybe, what's your personal take on non-contact ACL? What are some things maybe, I know we know like the valgus component of the knee, maybe some of those other things, or is there any other like big predisposers that you've seen in these athletes that are getting injured non-contact?
Well, before we dive into that, I want to thank you guys for having me again. When I was here last year, I was 5 days out from my shoulder replacement, and that's doing very well. And I've got one question. I know you guys get to ask most of the questions, but where did the name come from?
Gestalt. Yeah, Brett.
Well, basically it means the sum of all the parts is greater than any of the individual parts. So the thought was like, if, you know, like especially from a treatment standpoint, if we're combining all these different modalities and we do a good job at integrating together, we get the best result. So that's what the definition of Gestalt means.
I like it.
There's a guy, Viktor Frankl. He wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning, and he was a Gestalt psychologist, basically. Yeah. And so he studied people in the in like World War II concentration camps, and that's what he created Gestalt psychology onto. So that was.
But they say when you name something, you want to make it abstract enough. Therefore, you have to tell the story like we just did there, and then
That's why I asked.
Yeah,
I don't know where it came from.
Yeah,
for sure.
Beautiful. Yeah. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about
because you hear, I mean, you hear Q angle, quad hamstring ratio. We talked with you about like just like endocrine with females, like certain times of the month are more susceptible to ACL tears. So there's a lot of different like theories, but like what do you think are some of the main ones?
I mean, I think the main ones are probably related to A, proprioceptive issues that we have a difficult time measuring. I think quad to hamstring ratio strength is important. And I think gender does play some role, clearly. I mean, we all know that there's an epidemic of ACL injuries in women's basketball and women's soccer, in women's volleyball, multiples of more frequently or greater incidence than compared to male. So clearly, I think that the gender factor, whether that's hormonal, estrogen, whether it's pelvic anatomy and valgus angle. I think it's clearly multifactorial, and I'm not sure we have a good handle yet on those factors that A, we can control, and those factors we can't control.
There's been an explosion of ACL injuries in the NFL this year. A lot of people are like looking at, you know, the turf and things like that. Do you think it's just a random occurrence? Do you think it maybe there's certain supplements, growth hormones, things like that, or do you think it's just like a random occurrence that? Or tough to say.
I think it's difficult to say, but I think when you see a spike like you've seen, right, we see this in baseball, right? There's been a spike in the last few years in UCL surgeries, and everybody's trying to answer the question as to why. I think there has to be a reason why. I'm not sure we know why in the NFL now. There's been a lot of talk about turf, but studies that I'm familiar with haven't really shown a strong association with turf type. And you had Tim Hewitt here. Tim is one of the leading researchers in ACL injury prevention and the like. And I'm sure he had some insights, but I'm sure he didn't also have the answer. So
no, mm-hmm. Multifactorial.
Well, I think that's the hard part with these injuries. It is so multifactorial. And then you can have the you know, someone just have a bad luck. You know, you get rolled up on, something happens, and there it is, you know, that can do it. But maybe what about some predisposers or some predisposers for having a good outcome with a surgery? Meaning like, I know I do some of your pre-op therapies. What's some of the things that you're really looking for in a patient that is going to have a great outcome pre-op before you actually go on with surgery?
There are several things that I look for. The first thing I look for is I don't like operating on that sort of hot, angry, swollen knee. Mm-hmm. So first thing is to control the initial post-op or the post-injury hemarthrosis, post-operative synovitis, if you will. I don't like operating on the stiff knee. So I like to work on reestablishing range of motion, particularly looking for flexion to at least 90 degrees and obviously having them have reestablished full extension mm-hmm. before considering surgical intervention. You're looking at a lengthy recovery time anyway, and oftentimes these injured athletes are anxious to get it fixed. But I often say, let's invest 2 or 3 weeks preoperatively for some prehab, and that's gonna save you mm-hmm. significant time on the back end in terms of your overall recovery time frame. So I look for control of swelling, make sure it's not a hot swollen knee. I look for good range of motion, and I like athletes to have good quad control and restoration of quad function going into surgery, because obviously the surgical hit on the quad and the lower extremity muscle function is significant enough as it is. If they're already starting with a deficient or a dysfunctional quad and we're putting that surgical hit on them, it sets them even further back. So, mm-hmm.
And there seems to be kind of like a movement now of people who are opting to not have their ACL repaired. Do you have an opinion on that? Like, so I know that's also multifactorial, whether there's other tissues that are damaged and things like that, age and what they need to come back to. But I mean, are there high level athletes who are not getting their ACL repaired and still coming back and doing okay?
There are not any that I can think of that I'm you know, personally familiar with. Now, there are older athletes. We're talking about people in their 30s, 40s, 50s who have a non-contact injury, say, for example, skiing, but whose lifestyle is such is that they don't do a lot of twisting, pivoting, jumping sports. Mm-hmm. And those are people who I do think potentially deserve a trial of non-surgical treatment if it's an isolated ACL injury. I don't think every ACL injury needs reconstruction. You've really got to look at the individual. The flip side of that is historically, age has been a relative factor, and there are still surgeons who are reluctant to operate on older patients with ACL. The oldest patient I've operated on with an ACL deficient knee is 78 years old. The guy skied 90 days a year. He injured his ACL. He couldn't go back to skiing. We fixed his ACL, and he's back to skiing 80, 90 days a year. So age would be a relative factor there for not reconstructing it as well.
What about on those patients, maybe you do have a younger athlete that decides not to, other than instability, what are some of the other downsides of not fixing that? Can it lead to more arthritic changes, those types of things?
Well, we know very clearly, the data is very clear and the information is very clear. In our young, particularly our skeletally immature athletes, where this has been studied extensively, if those athletes do not have a reconstruction of the ACL, they have greater than 80% likelihood of going on to develop meniscal pathology and or chondral injury. Mm-hmm. So there is a higher association of developing meniscal pathology or chondral injuries in the ACL deficient knee, particularly if they have functional instability of the knee. So yes, clearly ACL deficiency increases the risk for some of those associated pathologies. We also know that in the ACL injured knee, generally speaking, there is an increased risk of developing osteoarthritis over the course of that individual's lifetime.
Even after repair.
Like even after repair. Either way, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the theory behind that is that there is disruption of the joint homeostasis. There's subacute chondral injury. There's alterations in metalloproteinases and other things that affect chondral health that occur at the time of injury. And even stabilizing the knee doesn't negate some of the effects of that injury, at least over the course of a lifetime.
And you've noticed that, like on your...
I advise my patients of that. Counsel them that, you know, this is an injury that even if we reconstruct your ACL and provide you with a stable knee, there's still an insult to the knee that occurred as a result of this injury that has the potential long-term implications of increased risk of arthritis.
Mm-hmm. And you have sometimes the unhappy triad where we damage the medial meniscus, the MCL, or fracture the patella. There's these other things that make for more difficult cases. Can you comment on that? Like, what is that? Does that affect prognosis? What does that mean?
Well, we know that the menisci, particularly the medial meniscus, are secondary stabilizers of the knee. We also know that loss of the meniscus alters the joint loads and the compressive forces on the articular surfaces. So particularly in the young athlete, in my opinion, preservation of the meniscus, meaning meniscus repair, is, in my opinion, as important as ACL reconstruction. Mm-hmm. So whenever possible, trying to preserve that that meniscus is critical. Obviously, if you're talking about a multi-ligament injured knee, whether it be an MCL injury, whether it be an ACL with an LCL and posterolateral corner, fixing the ACL is going to address the anterior to posterior instability and rotational instability, but you also have to worry about varus valgus laxity. So you've got to address the entire instability pattern if it's a complex knee injury.
Yeah. If you're watching on YouTube and you see us looking at the screen, we are in a battle right now. The SEC championship's going on, so Alabama, Georgia's playing. So anyway, we're kind of drinking some wine, watching football, and having a conversation, which is what's so beautiful about this podcast, right? Well, maybe let's
and hoping nobody injures their ACL.
Yeah, exactly. We don't want to see that. Well, maybe let's just shift gears a little bit as they go for it here on fourth and goal and Georgia scores. Let's get into the actual surgical procedure. Or maybe let me ask before that one question. Is there ever an instance where you won't have an MRI for a patient before you do surgery? Or is that just kind of commonplace? Like, you know that they tore their ACL, but you're still going to order the imaging. And is MRI still the gold standard?
Clinically, the diagnosis of ACL deficiency is relatively easy to make. We have good physical exam tests mm-hmm. that are highly sensitive and specific and can identify ACL insufficiency. But in my opinion, and we just talked about this, the frequency of associated pathology is high enough that I want to know that going into surgery. It's going to help with my pre-surgical planning. It's going to help with my counseling of the athlete and their family with regard to what the recovery looks like, because the post-op recovery and the post-op rehabilitation and the post-operative protocol for an isolated ACL versus an ACL with meniscus repair is different. So I believe that MRI is still the gold standard, and I do it primarily to A, confirm my clinical suspicion of a meniscus tear, but more importantly, to identify preoperatively associated pathology that's going to affect my surgical treatment plan and the postoperative recovery plan.
Perfect. Okay. So then let's go into that, you know, preoperative plan. Hamstring tendon, it seems to me like, is kind of going by the wayside. And that, like, research is kind of telling us that too. Tim Hewitt talked about that, but it seems like there's a little bit more of a resurgence in quad tendon. What is making the decision for you to determine what type of graft you're using? And is there any time that you would use a cadaver graft or anything along those lines too?
I have a fairly, I don't want to say rigid thought process on that, but hamstrings have gone by the wayside generally speaking, for our adult athletes. But hamstrings are the graft of choice in our skeletally mature athletes, where you have to worry about fascial injury and growth, leg length deformities or angular deformities. So hamstring still has a role in that select population. So for me, age is a significant factor in considering graft choice options. In the skeletally immature, hamstring reconstruction is the graft of choice, or hamstring is graft of choice, in my opinion. In the younger athlete, skeletally mature, but under age 40, let's say, my go-to graft these days is patella tendon. I didn't train using the quadricep tendon. The quadricep tendon has gained significant favor, and a lot of surgeons are using the quad tendon. The way I look at it is you're disrupting the extensor mechanism either way, whether you take a portion of the quad tendon or the central third of the patella tendon. I like the patella tendon because we take bone plugs with the patella tendon, and we have bone-to-bone healing of that graft within the tunnels that we drill in the tibia and the femur. Whereas with a quadricep graft, it's all soft tissue, so you have soft tissue healing to the bony tunnels. Additionally, I have not seen any literature which convinces me that the quadricep tendon provides a better outcome, a more rapid return to full participation than the quadricep tendon, than the hamstring tendon. So I basically use the autograft BTB as my workhorse in the vast majority of adult patients. In the older patient or the lower demand patient who doesn't participate in a lot of jumping, twisting, pivoting sports, high demand activities, I still think there's a role for an allograft or a cadaveric graft. And typically that cadaveric graft for me is a bone, tendon, bone as well, just an allograft donor bone, tendon, bone. Mm-hmm. So over 40, almost always allograft, bone, tendon, bone, or cadaveric tissue. Between 16 or skeletal maturity and age 40, almost always central one-third patella tendon autograft, skeletally immature hamstring. Hmm.
Beautiful. And then let's say you do decide that there is meniscal pathology, you're fixing the meniscal pathology, that post-op time frame where you are non-weight bearing, does that change in the presence of a pure isolated ACL versus meniscus versus other ligaments, or is that timeline pretty much the same in your eyes?
It's absolutely different in mm-hmm. my eyes. I moved to rapid weight bearing post isolated ACL reconstruction. My patients are typically on crutches for the first 7 to 10 days, 50% weight bearing, and then go to full weight bearing as tolerated thereafter. Whereas with meniscus pathology, we're speaking specifically about meniscus repair, those patients are typically non-weight bearing or toe touch weight bearing for 6 weeks on crutches. Mm-hmm. So there is a substantially longer time on crutches postoperatively with a concomitant meniscus repair, at least in my rehab protocols. And I believe that's factual for most orthopedists treating ACL and or meniscus pathology.
Yeah. In the re-tear rate, statistically, it's about between 5% and 10%. What are some of the things that you found can counteract that?
Well, as you said, historically, the traumatic re-tear rate has typically been somewhere between 5 and 10%. I think some of the things that we've learned is that premature return to play when the athlete's not fully rehabilitated or doesn't demonstrate good criteria for return to play certainly increases their risk for a recurrent injury. So that for me is the number one factor. You know, there's going to be re-injury if they're returning to contact sports, if they're returning to high energy twisting pivoting sports. And I don't think it's impossible to eliminate that completely. But I think for a while we had this trend towards trying to accelerate rehab and getting athletes back in 3, 4, 5, 6 months. And a lot of that started with Jerry Rice back in the 90s or whenever it was when he came back, you know, so quickly.
And then Adrian Peterson was the next
AP
one.
AP is really the main one who drove that. And now we've sort of moved away from that and moved back to, I don't want to say a more prolonged, but a more conservative time frame and a more definitive attention to return to play criteria that are more objective than just a physical exam and the athlete saying, hey, I'm ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Where is time? On average, is it, what is the time, do you think, on average? 6 months, 7 months?
I typically quote my athletes somewhere between 8 and 12 months. And I have I have objective criteria that I look toward to help guide me in counseling them on return to play. So it's, I don't think time in and of itself is a fixed measure. I think it's a relative measure. I do think that we can accelerate that, and we can outline a timetable that may be too short, mm-hmm. but I generally give them a very broad range of somewhere between 8 and 12 months on average.
What about the last time you were on, we were talking about the UCL with ligamentization. So when it actually will transform and take on the properties of the old ligament, is that same process occurring with the ACL? And is the time frame about similar? Or, I mean, like, where are we at on that?
So, yes, there is a process of graft incorporation, be it a soft tissue graft like the quadricep or the hamstring, be it bone-to-bone healing like a patellotendon graft. There is a process of graft incorporation, the graft tissue healing in the tunnels. There is a process of graft maturation with revascularization and cellular repopulation of the graft. And we have a very good understanding of that. There are a number of researchers, Scott Rodeo at Hospital for Special Surgery has taught us a lot about how soft tissue heals to bony tunnels. So we understand fairly well the biology of that process, and that's a process that takes months, not days and weeks, to occur. And then you have to have the graft, just like in the elbow, respond to progressive loads, because ultimately, right, that's what the graft is going to do. It's going to resist loads in the knee, particularly translational loads and rotational loads, and that graft has to see those in a progressive fashion to be able to respond to that and to align the collagen fibers and to be able to strengthen itself effectively.
Right. And progressive loading is really our only answer for that, correct? It's only going to respond to load or to strain.
Correct. Absolutely. It's live living tissue that's going to respond to load. Absolutely.
Yeah. Cool.
Last time when we were talking about UCL, we were kind of talking about when Frank Job did the original Tommy John surgery on Tommy John, how it's kind of miraculous how the surgery hasn't changed all that much. Is the same thing true with the ACL, or is it like, has it been evolving, or like what's that continuum kind of look like as far as the surgical correction of the ACL tear?
I mean, obviously, when ACL was first done, it was an open operation and then a mini open operation. In the vast majority of practitioners' hands now, it's an arthroscopic procedure. And there's been evolution of fixation devices from metal screws to non-metal screws to suspensory fixation devices. But overall, I would have to say that the process is very similar to what it was before. And these small technical advances, if you will, are nice, but I don't think that I can really point to any groundbreaking, earth-shattering step forward other than the move to arthroscopic, quite honestly.
Mm-hmm. And
was that James Andrews that did the first one, or was there somebody?
Do you know, I really don't know who did the first arthroscopic ACL reconstruction. Lanny Johnson, who was at Michigan State, was one of the early pioneers of arthroscopic surgery in the United States. I believe the first physician who really popularized it was a Japanese physician, Watanabe. But it's there've been a number of early leaders in the world of sports medicine who helped advance that.
And then what orthopedic testing, I'm assuming the Lachman,
pivot shift.
Yeah. What are the tests that you have found personally that you have had a lot of success with?
So on the physical exam side, the pathognomonic tests for ACL insufficiency are the Lachman exam and the pivot shift exam. Anterior draw is also a test that's done with the knee at 90 degrees of flexion, anterior drawer force on the tibia to try and assess the translation anteriorly. And those three are really the main workhorse exam findings. And again, most of us believe that a positive Lachman and a positive pivot shift are pathognomonic for ACL injury with or without any other associated pathology.
Yeah, right.
Beautiful. And then let's kind of get into return to sport a little bit. So you mentioned objective criteria, just knowing what you are asking for. That's strength, equal in strength. And then you also run most of your athletes through Dartfish. Is there any other objective criteria outside of those two things that you are, or what do you hold in higher standards outside of those two?
So the first and foremost hurdle that athletes have to get over, right, is the early rehabilitation. Have they reestablished full range of motion? Mm-hmm. Have they reestablished good quadricep function in terms of simple things like single leg squat, Second of all, do they have good stability of the knee? Is my examination of the knee consistent with an intact graft and a good stable knee? Those are factors that require physical examination, require some input from the athlete. And then I look at, once they've met those thresholds, I look at more sort of objective information. Because oftentimes you'll have an athlete look at you and say, hey, doc, I feel great. I'm ready to go. We put them through objective assessments. The first is typically either an isokinetic strength test or some objective measurement of their quadricep and hamstring strength. I look for a side-to-side difference in quadricep and hamstring strength of less than 20%. So stated another way, the operative leg has to demonstrate 80% of the strength of the non-operative leg. Once they meet that threshold, then typically I'll send them for some type of athletic movement screen, be it a dartfish analysis, something that looks at how they're loading that knee, how they're landing, how they're jumping, how they're moving laterally to see if, in fact, there's still abnormal valgus loads on that knee, load profiles that we know are going to increase the risk for re-injury. What I found over the course of my career is that if a patient doesn't pass that strength profile, they're going to fail the athletic movement screen. They're going to fail the dartfish analysis. So that's why for me, it's sort of a steeplechase effect. They got to pass the strength test first, to then be able to pass the motion analysis test.
Cool.
And since you're one of the experts in the world in UCL reconstruction, what parallels do you see or comparisons when you compare like UCL with ACL?
So I think that we're further behind in terms of identifying good objective return to play metrics for the UCL compared to the anterior cruciate ligament. Kevin Wilk, who's with Dr. Andrews, has done some work on this, and they use several different tests. They'll use a ball drop test. They'll use a couple of other sort of functional strength tests, but we don't really have the same objective measurements yet like we would with a dartfish analysis, for example, or an isokinetic strength test that gives us objective information. That's one of the goals and one of the areas that those of us who do a lot of ulnar collateral ligament surgery are sort of thinking about and working on, because that's a really long recovery, and a re-injury there, you're talking about, you know, several years of an athlete's career, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. And then once those objective criteria are met, what's the conversation like as far as return to sport? I mean, is it, is there any follow-up there? Is there, what things are you telling your athletes about reoccurrence, about what they can expect to feel and things like that later on?
Well, we've had the risk of reoccurrence rate before they've even had surgery.
Sure.
So that they understand that quite well. One of the analogies, at least in my experience, between ACL and UCL is, and we talked about this, I think, last time I was here, you know, our athletes for UCL surgeries oftentimes take 10 to 14 months to return. But when you talk to those athletes, they oftentimes tell you, hey, doc, it wasn't until that second year back that they really felt like they were back to normal. And I think that there's a similar experience with the ACL. There's this concept of proprioception, of the innate understanding of one's body's position in space or joint's position in space. And there's a proprioceptive disruption to a joint that undergoes ACL injury and ACL reconstruction. And I think that's part of the process that we can't quantify very well, and that takes a long time for the athlete to regain. So I oftentimes tell the athlete, hey, you'll be back after that first 8 to 12 months, but you may not feel like you're back to normal until that second year. Sure. And one of the factors that we've recognized much more clearly in the last decade is the psychological component to returning after a devastating injury like UCL. Mm-hmm. And there is a fear factor that comes into play that takes the athlete oftentimes a long time to recover from. And it's one of these things that we're still working on trying to figure out how to address, whether it's through sports psychology or what have you. But the fear factor is being recognized as a component that interferes with or at times prevents the athlete from returning to their same level of play.
There's an old saying, the brain never forgets, does it? Like, so it, and I mean, I think like if you compare like Adrian Peterson injury to Derrick Rose, when he, you know, had basically the same injury, Derrick Rose 2 years after the injury, I mean, they could not get him back on the court. I mean, basically the team doctors were like, it's time to go back on the court. Whereas like Adrian Peterson, you know, 5 months and some change, he basically has the second best year a running back has ever had. So you got to think that's more on like the biopsychosocial side of things as far as that, you know, I mean.
And I don't know all the specifics of Derrick Rose's injury pattern, whether it was identical to Adrian Peterson's and what the underlying condition of his knee may have been or associated pathology. But clearly that's, a, you know, that's an example of where there is some psychological fear of re-injury, biosocial, psychological, as you stated, a component to it. But we recognize that more in our athletes now as being another hurdle that they need to get over in order to successfully return to a level of participation and play equal to or superior to their pre-injury status.
Right. I got to ask you too, like there's a couple of anecdotal reports of you have complete rupturing of the ACL. And then there's been a couple reported cases of the two ends of the torn ACL finding each other. I know that can happen with the Achilles tendon also. I mean, does that actually happen or is that an error in the imaging or that just seems like so far-fetched to me?
Well, no, there's actually, there is a subset of surgeons now who are very enthusiastic about primary repair of the anterior cruciate ligament. Meaning if you can get to that injury early, particularly if it's an avulsion from the femoral origin or a tibial eminence type avulsion, repairing that ligament as opposed to reconstructing it and augmenting it with some type of internal brace, much like we do for primary repair of UCL. So that's an advancement that is in its infancy, but there are some providers who are very enthusiastic about repair of the anterior cruciate ligament. I've had a little bit of experience with it. Typically in my younger athletes who where that's where I tend to see this avulsion injury as opposed to a mid substance rupture. But that is an advance that is really in its infancy, but may change the way we treat a lot of ACL injuries.
That's insane. I mean, because what prompted is there's a lot of people on social media right now, you know, saying, "Oh, just cross brace our patients with these acute or ACL ruptures. They'll be fine. They'll return to play." But I think just from our experience and our argument with that, and I'm sure you maybe would agree, is like, yeah, you could do that, but what if you wait 8 weeks or 10 weeks and not repair it, and then it didn't. You know what I mean? Like
well,
you're
all the
further back.
That would occur, and it just makes sense that you'd have more osteoarthritis.
Right.
But I think that idea of cross bracing, the internal brace, that's what we effectively do with a UCL primary repair, is one that may have a role there. I think that one has to be thoughtful about who they apply that to. We have to follow that carefully. And I don't think, in my opinion, it's at the point in time where it's the answer for everybody. I still think reconstruction is the answer for most ACL injured athletes. Again, it's a good analogy to the ulnar collateral ligament. You know, I was one of the early adopters of the internal brace for primary repair of the UCL. And there was a great enthusiasm for that, and we've tempered that a little bit and refined our indications for that, and we understand better who that operation works best on. And the enthusiasm now in the world of UCL reconstruction is for these hybrid reconstructions that include a graft plus a spanning suture like an internal brace. So it's continuing to evolve there as well, but just thinking back to your question about sort of advances or changes in ACL surgery, I think this is one that will play a role going forward. I think like many advances in orthopedic surgery, oftentimes there's an overshoot on that initial enthusiasm, and then we start to look at it critically and understand who the best candidates are for those particular techniques or procedures.
Beautiful. Well done. I just have to speak. I have to give you a compliment because we send all our ACLs to you because they do so well. And so I appreciate your willingness to blur the lines a little bit and for return to play. Not blur the lines, that's the wrong word, but be objective in the return to play. Because it is a tough decision. You know, like I can't tell you being on the front lines of parents pressing you and people pressing you, coaches telling you to get your kid back. But to be able to have objective data to say, yes, you are ready to go or no, you are ready not or you're not ready to go. Like it's an easier conversation for me to have on the front lines too.
Well, I will tell you, it makes it, I've rarely had an athlete or a parent where the athlete passes those tests and the athlete looks at you and says, "I don't think I'm ready to go, doc." Okay. It's usually the other scenario where the athletes look at you saying, I feel great, I'm ready to go. Right. And then I look at that objective data and I sit down with mom and dad, or I sit down with the athlete and say, look, your quadricep is still 40% down. Mm-hmm. There's not a chance you're going to pass the functional analysis and you're going to be at risk for re-injury. Or, hey, you've passed the strength test. Now let's go to the next step. But look it, you're still landing improperly. Look at the pictures. Look how much valgus load you have on your knee compared to the opposite side. And those objective pieces of information help me help the athlete accept the fact that he or she is not ready to go yet. It's rarely the other way around where they pass those things and say, I don't think I'm ready to go, doc.
Right.
And Taylor hears me talk about this all the time, but I think Dr. Paletta's one of his biggest gold medals. I've never in my life seen any physician, whether it's an orthopedic surgeon, chiropractor, PT, lay out a plan and expectations like you do. And I think that is one of the secrets to why you're so successful and being around you. And when I was with the Cardinals, I tell him that story all the time. The one thing I learned from you more than anything else probably is how important it is, like, establishing expectations with the players. And I think, like, then you get buy-in. And I think it is so important in that world. And I feel like, honestly, even in your world, orthopedic surgeons actually are not good at that. Like, I feel like you're, like, very, very good at explaining what this injury looks like next week, 4 weeks from now, 6 months from now, and they know what to expect. And I think, like, that is very, very important.
I mean, if we talk about ACL, right, usually you're looking at a timetable for return to play of somewhere between 8 and 12 months. So obviously that's the ultimate expectation and end game. But there are many hurdles that the athlete needs to overcome. Mm-hmm. And in my experience and in my philosophy, every time they overcome one of those hurdles, that's positive feedback. And they understand that they're making the progress that they need to make to achieve that ultimate goal. If you don't lay out those hurdles and they don't know that they're making that type of progress, I find that sometimes psychologically it's more of a challenge. The other thing is that if you give them these little hurdles to get over, and so when I see a kid 2 weeks after ACL, I'll say to him, hey, Joe, you know, you got three goals, and it's on my rehab protocol. You've got three goals for the next 4 weeks till I see you 6 weeks post-op. I want to see zero or no swelling, so continue to ice it, continue to use modalities with your therapist and your trainer. I want you to see you flexing to at least 90 degrees, and I want to see you be able to do a straight leg raise. So what have I done there? We're reducing joint inflammation, joint irritation by reducing the swelling. We're making sure they're progressing with regard to range of motion, that they have full extension and are flexing to at least 90, and we're making sure that they're reestablishing quadricep control. If I explained it to the kid that way, I might lose the kid. But if I say, look, no swelling, bending the 90 degrees, straight leg raise, they know those are three things they do. When they come back at 6 weeks post-op, I say, hey, Joe, you did great. You've met all three of these. In the next 6 weeks, you've got to normalize your gait pattern. I don't want to see you coming in here with a limp. I want you to have full range of motion, and I want you to have improved quadricep function. That's another hurdle the kid gets over. And he comes in and he thinks, man, I'm doing great. I'm right where I'm supposed to be. So for me, it helps navigate that journey to the ultimate endpoint, because it gives the kids points and it gives the athletes points of achievement, points of success. And if they don't make those goals, it's an opportunity for me to say to them and look at it and say, why aren't we making these goals? Are we not doing enough therapy? Are we not doing the right therapy? Are you not doing your home exercise program? Where are we falling short so that we can adapt the program accordingly? So for me, laying out short-term expectations that help get us to that ultimate long-term goal, smooth out the athlete's acceptance of their injury, the acceptance of their recovery journey, and I think the success of that recovery journey.
I think too, like, you're really good about not coming across as cocky, but being certain and confident. How important do you think that is in exuding what you're trying to do with these athletes? I mean, you're needing them to buy in on what you're doing. And I feel like a lot of times, especially in the world of professional athletes, they need to feel that confidence that you're going to be the one that's going to be able to help them. And that delicate balance of, I mean, because orthopedic surgeons, no offense, you know, people think that sometimes they're cocky and they're arrogant. And
I mean, you have to think about where these athletes are. Let's start with a professional athlete who has a devastating injury, be it a UCL injury, be it an ACL injury. You know, all the things that are running through their mind not only affect thoughts about their knee or their elbow, it affects their thoughts identity. About yeah. their identity, yeah, exactly. their career, their earning potential, but particularly their identity. And they're looking for, they don't have the expertise to understand what has to be done and what it takes to get back. All they know is that's where they want to be. And I, in my experience of 25 plus years taking care of professional athletes and recreational athletes, they're looking for somebody to lay out a plan to let them know there's a pathway to being all right again,
beautiful,
to being well again. And that's my job. Yes, I've got the technical job of doing a good surgical procedure, but I also have the job of shepherding their recovery and overseeing their recovery and giving them the tools, both physically and mentally, to understand what that recovery process looks like. And if you don't do that confidently, they already have doubts. They already have doubts about, am I going to get back to, for my senior year of high school baseball? Am I going to get back to pitching, you know, in the MLB playoffs? They already have those doubts. I need to do something to dispel those doubts. I need to do something to quiet those doubts. I need to do something to ensure in them the confidence that they can do what they need to do to get back to where they want to be. And for me, that's confidently presenting a plan and giving them these hurdles or milestones to achieve each step of the way.
That is such a clinical pearl. Mm-hmm. That is perfect.
You guys ever heard of a walk-off?
Yeah,
that was a walk-off.
That's a walk-off.
That was it.
Yeah,
George, thank you so much. Pleasure. I really appreciate
being back here. Yeah. As always.
Thank you so much, guys.
I appreciate the fine
Cheers.
Wine.
Yeah, one more time.
I'm glad I'm not in the sling. Yeah, and I can raise my arm over my head. Appreciate
right. Cheers,
that.
Cheers, guys. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. And keep exuding confidence, being confident in what you're doing with patience, and lay out a plan, damn it. So we'll see you next time. Good luck with patience. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Gasol Education Show. If you liked it, share it, subscribe to it, send it to your friends, send it to someone that needs to hear this message. We really want everyone to be able to tune in and get the best clinical advice that they can, which we're hoping that we're giving to you with these special guests. So if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to us, or if you have any suggestions on upcoming conversations, let us know. For a list of our upcoming courses, we're adding them all the dang time. So go to gestaltedu.com, click on courses, and they'll all be right there for you. All right, have a good day.